breathing.
Yeah.
Yeah, I just need to make sure it doesn't crash with my glasses, so... Yeah, can you hear? So it's working? Can you hear some echo? Yeah. Right.
Well, I can see absolutely zero of that, which means everybody's going to have to use the stream from that one for listening to
actually see. Right. Yeah, but that's a punishment for not turning up, so. Yes, I'm presenting motivation, an article about the motivation to participate in the FoldIt, the citizen science project. The FoldIt is an online citizen science project, as I said. And there's been several citizen science projects in the throughout the 90s and the O's, but only in recent decade or so have been online services for this. The online services is a lot easier than the offline one. And can also encourage micro-volunteerism in terms of doing a smaller task rather than large ones. It's also much easier to set up forums for this, where they can, where the participants can discuss both with each other and with those in charge of the citizen science project. Previously, distributed computing has been the most popular online science projects at all, but. Many have discussed whether this is a gamification of science or not, because you're not technically doing something yourself. Instead, you're helping others do something by letting them use your hardware. Allowing them to use your processor or your hard drive and use them for cloud computing. In recent years, Galaxy Zoo has been the main object for online citizen science, largest one as well, where you thousands of people across the world look at various galaxies that NASA, ESA, and so on have found, and then classify them according to what they look like. They've already made several hundred classifications this way. The problem with online citizen science is that they tend to be a bit difficult though to use, because since they're scientific, they have to be really, really complex in order to make it actual scientific and give a contribution to science, which means you need a lot of tutorials in order to make it understandable and how to use it. General motivation for these kinds of things are scientific contribution, obviously, to enhance technical skills, which is usually more true with the cloud computing services in previous years. Competition, in terms that if something is to be gamified, you usually need scoreboards and leaderboards anyway, so you naturally get competition that way. And of course, an interest in science. If you're not interested in science, you would usually just play a regular game instead. Scientific contribution and interest in science will turn up again and again later on in both the document and in the presentation. FoldIt itself was created in 2008, and is a way to classify proteins in a three-dimensional way. It's usually been really difficult by scientists to classify proteins and understand how they're built up and made. For example, a team of experts spent more than a decade in trying to classified the simian AIDS virus, while a team of Foldit gamers did it in a matter of weeks when it was available to them. So it's a bit of a difference. Can strongly aid scientific research this way. They have to do this in a natural configured way in order for it to be approved by the admins, so to speak, and the experts. Your score is then based on how close it resembles the actual natural way. And the teams that discovered the simian AIDS virus got nearly full score, of course. It consists of 32 tutorials, every single one of which is supposedly really difficult and takes a long time to understand and complete. But the community is very tightly knitted together and will help new gamers in order to get them into the project. Because it's so difficult to learn, only 200 people are registered users, but they don't have an exact number because they don't actually register any official places. Instead, they have several forums that they turn up to, and it's just an estimate based on the number of people in those forums. Amongst those 200 to 300, only 20 or 30 are core players that have been played for years and play up to a dozen hours a week, and thereby helping, contributing to science. So the way they analyzed why you would participate in something like this is that they sent out questionnaires to everyone that were registered, but only 47 of them responded. Not a lot, but compared to just 200 to 300 people who participate, it's still a decent number. They did it in three ways: participant observation, online survey, and semi-structured interviews. The online survey was the first to be sent out. In the survey, they gave the option to send your email and Skype and so on in order if you wanted to be contacted further. Only a few were willing to do this and therefore became part of the semi-structured interviews afterwards. In the interviews, they naturally interviewed everyone, and in the interviews they asked if any one of them wanted to be observed while they were playing, but again only a few of those who were interviewed were willing to be observed. The author did describe that this may be a convenience loophole, as it was not mandatory to fill out neither the survey nor participate in the interviews. It may be a biased in the terms of the data collected from these things. In the participant observation, there was used a lot of technical language, which the author had some trouble understanding, but all the participants were fully willing to look over this. They also used a lot of technical language in the forums themselves, most of the observed participants stated that one of their primary goals for this was to prevent the protein misfolding, because some of them actually had family members who were themselves had diseases because of protein misfolding, such as Alzheimer's disease. In the online survey, 46% of those who responded were undergraduates, 34% of those were postgraduates, but only 2 were scientists. So although it's a very scientific community, only about half of them actually have degrees. And 49% of those who were did respond were playing 15 hours a week, which means that the rest were playing less than 15 hours. So that's where you get the difference between the core players and the regular players. And the main reasons for participating is the contribution to science, interest in science, challenge, and curiosity to the field. In the interview, the interviewees stated that the reason they participated was because of a diverse community. And took really pride in what they were doing, as they felt they had made significant contributions to science and research on these topics. In conclusion, did all feel that they made a contribution to science? The author made a table of motivation, which you can see here, where there are on the level one you can see the specific motivational reasons. Well, in level four you can see the group together ones. Somewhat easy to understand and sums up the conclusions fairly well. She also summarized that the forums and the chat were main reasons for why you would continue playing this game, as many games for science have neglected forums and chats and have lost players over time because of this. But because the core players are very heavily interested in keeping the forums going, then that should be one of the main topics for future games for science. Fans of science seems to be the main participants in these kind of studies as well, but that's to be expected, of course. And the level of difficulty seems to also have a huge impact in the number of participants, as the more difficult it is, the more people drop out at an early stage. Yeah. Thank you. Yeah. Switch over.
I will cue the video opposition. I have, of course, many questions myself, as I'm sure Runa also has some. Questions, and fingers crossed this actually works. Yeah. Oh my god, you're seeing it.
Hi. I will, in this short video, present to you my three questions to the citizen science paper. First question. It's mentioned that the survey might not be representative of the total population of active participants in the game. Is this really a problem in this case, when we know that the goal of the study is to see what motivates the ones who are the most active players?
Yeah, no, I don't think it's a problem. It's just a statement that it may be perceived as a problem by some, but overall, it's as it may not be.
So my take on this is that given that the conclusions include that having a forum is an important aspect for continued motivation.
Yeah, and Yeah, that might be. So, in regards to the forums being an important part, may be a problem. However, games like this tend to be, as I said, technically difficult to learn. So you need forums to help you understand how to use them.
Yes.
So it is still a valid conclusion.
Oh, you could use, you may need forums to use them.
Yeah.
Representationness of this means that you are going to a group of respond yeah. that they're engaging in forums. And who are of the people who are engaging in forums, those who are then willing to fill in a survey about the game they're playing.
Yeah, only the social ones will do something like that.
So the people on forums, you're not, so you don't get lurkers, right? So if the forums are being used by the majority, because if you've only got 37 out of 200,
yeah.
right, then it could be that the majority of people on the forums are lurkers who are reading what other, who are there not to interact with people, but are there to learn stuff.
Yeah.
And so they're just reading what other people are talking about.
Yeah.
And they never contribute because they're not interested in contributing. So for them, it's not the interaction contribution aspect that's important. It's the information provided that's important. And it could have been a web page or it could have been a forum. For them, it wouldn't matter.
Yeah.
But they're not going to tell you that because they're not interacting in the forum.
Yeah.
That's not what they do. So the only people who respond to your survey are those who are in the forum and are interacting.
Yeah, and that's one of the main problems with surveys at all. No. It's difficult to ask those people questions because they're not willing to either way. Yeah. Yeah. Yep.
So, for me, I think it is a problem. Or it's a problem for the types of conclusions that are there. It wouldn't be a problem if it's very clear you're saying people who are engaged in forums and who will respond to surveys, what are they like?
Yeah.
Right? Rather than what are folded players like.
Yeah.
Right? And I think that's those are two quite different settings.
Yep. Yeah. Okay.
Second question. Do you think that the results found in this study regarding motivation is transferable to other type of games? Or do you think that the results are special for people contributing in online citizen science projects?
Yeah, he asked what do you think. So personally, I think that most of this is somewhat general at least. She mentioned that the interest in science and participation in forums are important. Forums, as we already discussed, so not need to go more into that, but the interest in science is, I think, really important in order to play scientifically contributed games. So, yeah, I think there is some generalizability in this article.
So, one of the things that I look at is in terms of game quality and motivation. One of the benefits of having an interest in science is that you're already motivated to do the activity.
Yeah.
And you are just. So, your game doesn't necessarily have to be as good as something that you would play purely intrinsically for its own entertainment. Because you have another reason to do it.
Yeah.
Right? And so the generalizability is well, in terms of the results, they're saying that forums are important.
Yeah.
And one of the preconditions is an interest in science. Now, this, for me, again, this comes back to a sampling right, issue. And I've seen this done. Bring up women in computer science.
Yeah.
If you ask women who do computer science, you have one here. if you ask women who do computer science, what motivates you to do computer science, and you analyze them and say, great, we now know why women do computer science. So what we do is we go to other women and we say, right, here's what we do to get you to do computer science. And the other women go, what?
Yeah.
Sampling group that is already involved in an activity, right? And are already doing something, and it's a relatively small group, right?
Yeah.
Is there something about that group that is different to the rest of the population, which is why they're there?
Yeah.
So in terms of generalizability, if you can find another community that has similar interests and attitudes as the scientific participation community, can't do you generalize it in the same way? Now, that's not saying it can't be generalized, So how would you design an experiment to see if this is generalizable?
Yeah, would probably take a first take a random sample of a population, and then put up several types of games, including games for science, and see what they think contributes not only to science itself, but also what they would be willing to play onwards, and see what they think is would be fun to play and what they would stop playing almost immediately. Yeah. If it's against the general population, that's what I would do.
Right.
But if it's against just the scientific community, I would just put it up against other games for science.
So that would be that would measure generalizability of the games. Probably.
Yeah.
How would you see if her results were generalizable? Because her conclusions are around the important forums and
yeah. So,
how would you assess whether that was true?
In order to assess whether that was true, I would have to force people who are don't participate in forums to actually respond to my questions. Because if I do the same thing with other scientific games, I'm just going to get the same answers with people in forums responding back to me, and they're going to say that forums are important yet again.
When you're generalizing something, you look at the example you use and the people you talk about, and then you look at how that generalizes at. Right? So one form of generalization is, does this apply to other scientific communities other than this scientific community that also have forums?
Yeah.
The one I was thinking of, another generalization, would be, could you do a similar analysis of a sports team, for example, right? And say, well, the forum, is the communication in the forum important? Are they pre-existing understanding of being interested in the result of something?
Yeah.
And motivating you to therefore engage. And, you know, if you look at that, like team support, right? If your model of your local team winning is involved with you going there and cheering for them, right? So you're interested in the result, you are turning up to be part of something and participate and try and help an objective. So could you find the same characteristic of what's important for motivation and doing a favor in another community?
Most likely, yes, because again, you'll not necessarily by forums, but similar things to forums, like socializing in bars, for example, or actually turning up for the game with a bunch of friends. Wearing costumes and so on. If you ask the same type of sample, social people, then they're probably going to give you similar answers.
They might give you similar answers saying, the social aspect of turning up to the game is important to me.
Yeah.
Right? There may be a bunch of people who turn up to the game to watch it, who aren't social.
Yeah, but... Yeah, and then there's a lot of people who won't turn up to the game at all, who still care about the sport, and you can't ask them, because they're at home.
They're at home, and so they can't tell you that, you know, I'm watching, I'm very interested in the result, I just don't feel that it's important for me to go and stand there and cheer.
Exactly. So, if you did it the same way, and it's really difficult to find other ways to do it, then you would probably get the same thing in other areas.
Yeah, and so what... So, to some extent, if we think that that might be true... if you were designing a folded game, right, a game for citizen science, the implications of this research, what do you think are the most valuable part?
The most valuable part for me would be to both make it easy to understand, or at least make simple to use tutorials so you can learn the tools, as well as create well-structured forums, as they've said. Because even if not everyone uses forums actively themselves, they can still read forums. As computer scientists, we know that using forums to help you ask questions is quite important at times. Yes, not more than game elements, but it's an additional important aspect. So it shouldn't eat up the time for development in the game, but should instead be added to the end of the game development cycle.
Well, so there's an interesting question around the end of the game cycle. Should you be creating that community early and get them involved in the design of the game?
Yeah. Early access versus
early access
product release.
So an early access style community.
That's already an ongoing question around the world in games
So. In games in general, and so for these scientific communities, is that potentially even more important to build that core base?
It may be, because other scientists in the field can give you vital feedback on the subject, even if whether you're doing something right or doing something wrong in the research itself.
Third question. In the online survey, they found out that just over half of the respondents stated that Foldit was the only computer game they played. Do you think that the game could have solved more scientific problems if it was more appealing to typical gamers and thereby attracted more contributors?
That's a difficult question, actually. The reason it's not attracted gamers is its difficulty to actually use the game or play the game, obviously. But I'm not sure whether it would help or not if gamers outside of the scientific community would help with the game and play the game actively. I really don't know, so I can't answer that question.
So I see two parts to this.
Yeah.
So one is the being attractive to other gamers. The response that this is the only game I play.
Yeah.
Isn't necessarily saying I'm not a game.
No, you can still be a gamer and just play one game. So.
You can still enjoy games and only be currently playing one game.
Yeah.
Right? You often find this with, people in high school might have played five or six different sports in high school.
Yeah.
And then once they leave high school, they might lock down to just one of those. Because they only have time for one of them. They're still interested in a group of sports, it's just they've only got time to commit to one of them, so they only do one.
Yeah.
So that response isn't necessarily I'm only ever going to play one game.
No. So it's like saying that World of Warcraft gamers are not gamers, for example. Yeah.
The word game, right?
Yeah. So if you play several games or one, how often do you play?
How do you find the word? How do we find gamers, right?
Yeah.
So my personal opinion is that, and how I would like gamer to be used, but it isn't currently used, is in the same way you would refer to wine buffs.
So people who enjoy games, in other words.
Right.
And so people who understand games then.
Yes, and talk about games. Don't just drink a lot of wine, but understand the subtleties of wine, how it's made, the different varieties, the different tastes of the different varieties. So for me, a gamer should refer to people who treat games as a hobby that they engage with and are interested in and can discuss.
Mm.
So you could be a gamer in the esports setting, or you might not be, right? Just the fact of like playing games doesn't define you as a gamer. It's like,
well, you know everything about that game, just as one person you know everything about wine.
But they don't know anything about a single one, right? They know about one, right?
Yeah.
Not about a single one. Yeah, so it, but it's
Yeah, that's comes back to the same thing then. If you only play one game and that game is Foldit, do you know about other games then?
Yeah.
And are you therefore a gamer or not?
Yes, and also there is the question of do you have any right to make a comparison or an evaluation of the game you play if you've only played one of them?
Yeah.
Right? Like, how good is this game? Oh, it's fantastic. Have you played any other? No. You know, it's fantastic. It might be the worst game in the world if you've never played another one.
Mm.
There is a lot of challenge around defining what a gamer is,
mm.
Because the other interpretation of gamer is anyone who plays game, and at that point it's, well, you know, does that include Tag that with the children? Does that make everyone who's ever played Tag a gamer, which would then make the word human, because it would be irrelevant to call someone a gamer because
yeah.
you're just defining that you exist.
Yeah, does that are animals gamers then? Because they often play with each other.
So you'd say that, yes, they are. They play games and therefore they are gamers. And well, it's not a useful term once it has no group that it excludes.
Yeah.
So there has to be something to be excluded for a term to be useful.
Mm.
Yeah? So appealing to gamers.
Yeah.
There's obviously a group of people he's referring to here as gamers.
Mm.
Which.
We don't know what it is unless they can be here and discuss it. So.
Yeah, and the second part of this is also, do you want an activity to be appealing for people who aren't motivated by the science?
And that's exactly the question I found it difficult to answer, because you can still contribute to science even if you're not interested in it.
Mm.
But is that contribution good or bad?
Are you taking up resource and time and just making the world noisier by your contribution? And
that's an interesting debate, because gamers, they get good at something in the gaming.
Mm.
You get refined skills there.
Mm.
And so is it worse to have the refined skills in solving scientific challenges than
fantasy challenges?
I'm not so sure.
What do you guys think?
Well, I've played a lot of games. When you get good at a game, I did play World of Warcraft a lot before.
So are the skills here transferable within science or games then?
Does this make you a better scientist?
Yeah.
Or does it make you a better gamer? And so the last question, a question I have, but the question I have is around ethics.
Okay. Yeah.
So In Bogus does the whole exploitation weird debate. Mm. Right? So, given that understanding how proteins fold and doing that work is paid work for some people, is it exploitative to turn that into a game and have all of these undergraduate and postgraduate students using their personal time to put other people out of work?
Mm. That's a difficult question. I think it depends on the people themselves, how much time they spend.
Because are you exploiting them? Are you using the game rewards to exploit people's kind of charity and make them spend long hours doing work for you, which they don't get any benefit from?
Well, do you get some benefit because the teams are posted that discover these things, mm-hmm. in Fall Date at least. So that you do get recognition in that term, alongside the game folded.
Yeah, so there are so. Yeah,
so
but then there's an intrinsic value there because they want to solve the problem.
Yeah.
Would there be a better way of doing it? Because once you've only got 200 to 300 players and 20 to 30 core players, could you have just made a better scientific interface for doing things rather than try and make it a fun game?
How?
So
that's the important question there. So probably could, but yeah, how? So what is a good interface in these kinds of games? And why would this interface be bad? Because it needs to be very specific and very technical in order to contribute to this form of science.
So did you play Folded?
No, I haven't played it myself.
I have,
you have.
Yeah, no, I downloaded it. I think it's still got on that machine, and you are kind of you playing with a thing and you're trying to twist it and trying to see what it does and trying to kind of work out how to move things around and create it. And it has a pretty visual thing and it gives you points and it gives you score and it shows things when they're wrong and it's all those sort of things. But for the amount of effort that went in to fold it, having 20 to 30 core players and 200 total players, is it really worth all of that effort that goes into making the game?
Yes, because of the what was the disease called that they discovered in second? The AIDS virus that they discovered. And a team of experts had already spent a decade trying to figure it out. And then a team of two teams actually of folded gamers discovered it in 2 weeks. So considering the number of people who are affected with the simian AIDS virus, it will be worth it in the end, because it helps the scientific community then figure out more about the disease and potentially find a cure for it later. Potentially. So I think it depends on the field within each area. So, for example, the Galaxy game for science. It might be more important to make a good game in order to get as many people to contribute as possible, because then you can name the types of galaxies by popular vote, rather than just trying to come up with the scientific terms for them. Yeah, for that it might be a bit of both.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So Foldit does abstract what's going on quite a lot.
Mm.
Right? So you're trying to find that new ground. And it is worth having a look at the game and I can probably bring it up here during the break. But do we have any not currently. We'll do that later. So the final thing is like if you were to do this study, how would you do it better?
This is a study to motivational gamers, so I'm not sure if I could do it better. So I would probably have done it in roughly the same way, and try to give the people who play the game questionnaires and see what responses I get back. And then I would just get the same kind of responses from the same kind of people.
You think this would be relatively repeatable?
Yes.
So you think if you'd get similar results if you did a similar...
Yeah, I think it.
Which that gives us some dumb question about novelty.
Yeah.
So one of the things they talk about when they did publishing was how novel is this result, and how much does it contribute to new knowledge?
Yeah. I don't think this contributed so much to new knowledge instead of just approving pre-existing knowledge in terms of complexity, gamification, and forums, socializing, and so on. Yes, and those who responded said that it mattered a lot to them. Yeah. But then that gets back to the same question that who answered those questionnaires, and it was most likely the forum users. Yeah. Yeah.
Okay, so I'll just come in with a meta thought here. I agree with you. I also believe that forums are important for retention. But this doesn't provide evidence of that for the rest of the population. It only provides evidence for that for the people who are engaged in forums and who are willing to respond to surveys and engage in forums. Right? Now,
how do you ask people who aren't in the forums?
Yeah, so
that's the problem I would have had if I was to do this.
So one of the things you've got to be careful of, and is it for any of you guys doing any research, is does the sample you've got and does the evidence you've collected support the thing you're trying to say? Even if the thing you're trying to say is true, right, and you believe it and is like most likely true, your evidence may not provide additional evidence to support that belief.
Yeah.
So even though you say I think forums are very important for other players to be able to remain and learn from the forums, this survey wouldn't provide you any information about that particular group. And so although that's probably true, this doesn't help you save that, make that statement. Mm. Right? So to make that statement, you'd have a couple of options. One would be an A-B testing, where you provide the game to one group of people and no access to forums, and to another group of people with access to forums, and see which group has more players in it after 6 months. Right? But that's kind of stabbing yourself in the foot, because you're wanting more players. You believe the science is important, so you don't really care whether it's the forum that's actually important. You just want more people to play. So if it's important, great. If it's not important, I don't care. I just want more people to play. Right? So yeah, it got that challenge of like when you do a medical treatment, right? When you're doing an intervention, if you find a pill that you're giving to people, and 100% of the people you give the pill to recover, and 10% of people who don't get the pill recover naturally, how long into your trial do you say, okay, screw this, we're just going to give the pill to everybody rather than keep letting people die just to make sure it actually works?
That's not up to the doctors, though. That's up to the EU, for example, other bodies that have made laws about this. Games don't have that. Yeah.
So still has to make those decisions.
Yeah, so the politicians have to make those decisions, but politicians don't know what to do because they get both people who want it to drag on as long as possible and people who want to get it out as quickly as possible.
And we, as master students, are supposed to, and master graduates, we are supposed to be providing expert assistance to the and including decision makers and politicians, right? So part of your future is to be the experts that tell the politicians what is actually going on, right? So yes, we can engage in these sort of debates. Is that what, like, how much should you do to test your theories around whether your game is useful? If your actual end result is to try and classify a medical condition and just more is better, we don't actually care what, right? So there's that kind of trying to work out what the balance is. And that goes, so games of science is also the last thing I'll say before we take a break. Games of health. Games of health and games for education both benefit play. This one benefits science.
Yeah, so science, if you say it benefits science, then it often, not always, but often benefits humanity in itself.
So
and human understanding of the universe.
Yeah. So to some extent, you could also say to some of these people, it is benefiting the player because they know that the science will benefit them.
Science
order
they have
benefited them.
Yeah.
And so it's indirect benefit.
Yeah.
But it also still benefits them.
Yeah. There was only one that we've asked each other right here and now quite a lot, whether they were active posters on the forums or crawlers. I don't think they asked that question. So you don't know if there were any crawlers who just happened to answer the questionnaire. They should have asked that question in order to break that down as well. I probably would not, because it's important to keep questionnaires relatively short as well in order to increase both participation level and to make sure that they don't just answer bullshit and make sure that the answers are genuine. So if you ask too many questions, then...
beyond
that. There weren't anything Yeah, there weren't anything that I thought of while I read it. I can probably think of something if I give me a couple of hours to think, but not that on top of my head. Yeah. Yeah.
Like this is kind of how a level of saying, I think Google saying in the scientific methodology research deals on top of previous research. If
yeah.
you follow up this study and you had acceptance from the community that they should answer your questionnaire or they will be involved in a new study, because I think it's important that for science that they know the game for science.
Yeah. What I would be looking for then would probably be along the lines of what makes this a good game, if it is a good game.
Game
mechanics, right? Yeah, the more game mechanic related questions and game design related questions, rather than just the more scientific questions that she asked. So in order to that would be more in order to create an actual good scientific game rather than a good scientific community and reasons for playing it. No, I don't think so. And just classify them by whether they how they use the forums and how much they use the forums, probably, but not that much more than that, no.
Something the tweet shaking, that's all. Right, so, yes. So this is, yeah, so a bunch of abstracted tools and an abstract look, and but still relatively complex.
Yeah.
Okay, so take a 10-minute break, and
yep.
We'll see you back for...
Okay, so for the second presentation, we have Thomas, who will present via video, and we're recording there, and I'll be him here, but I'll present. Okay, so.
I am Thomas Hatlebakke. I'm one of the part-time students in this course, and I am based in Bergen. Therefore, I will give you my presentation in this video. My chosen topic is games and diet, weight loss and gain. And the paper I'm going to present for you is a study about social motivations to use gamification. The paper investigates the social factors network exposure, social influence, recognition, and reciprocal benefits, and how they predict users' attitude towards gamification. His intention to continue using gamified services, and also his intention to recommend gamified services to other people. The core of the research model is based on the theory of planned behavior. This is a theory that links beliefs and behavior. The theory is supposed to explain human behavior, and it's a good way to look at the relations between beliefs, attitudes, and behavioral intentions. The theory of planned behavior has been extended with factors related to network exposure, recognition, and perceived reciprocal benefits, in addition to social influence. The three last mentioned are all factors that were hypothesized to be relevant social factors predicting attitudes and use behavior in gamification service. With network exposure, they look at how the number of friends or connections in the system is essential for the user's attitude toward the system. The researchers in this study hypothesized that the network exposure did not influence the attitude directly, but instead mediated by the other social factors. And that's the three you see in the middle. Social influence is supposed to reflect the user's perceptions of how other users perceive the service, while recognition describes the social feedback a user receives on their actions in the system through likes, comments, and so on. Reciprocal benefit is how the users contribute to the community and then receive a benefit in return. A total of 10 hypotheses was carried out. I will not list all of the 10 here, but in short, you can say that each line between the factors represents one hypothesis, and it illustrates that the factor it goes from positively influences the factor it points to. In the study, they gathered data from users in the gamified exercise tracking service Fitocracy. I think that this is a suitable service to look at when it comes to social motivations and gamification, since this one provides game-like features like objectives, rewards, tracking, and monitoring of activities. All this in a social setting where people collect badges, compete in leaderboards, and receive recognition based on how many points they collect. So feedback from other users on achievements is also an important part of this aspect. The data in the study was gathered with an online questionnaire, which was posted in the discussion forum and groups within the service. It was only accessible for users of the service, and a total of 107 responses were gathered in a period of 3 weeks. The respondents were given the opportunity to win a $50 Amazon gift card. I'm not quite sure if the results from the questionnaire are representative for all of the users of the service, since it was posted to the discussion board, but who is using the discussion board? I'm thinking that it might be that only one type of people are using the discussion board, such as people who are more dedicated to the service than others. So in my opinion, this might lead to skewed results. The results, as we can see here, they support all of the 10 hypotheses, actually, except one. And that's the one saying that recognition positively influences attitude toward the use of gamification. This one actually surprised me a bit, as I thought that recognition from other users would boost the attitude toward the system. But we can still see that it has an indirect effect on attitude through reciprocal benefit. We can also see that the network exposure positively influences all the three other social factors in the middle of the model. It also shows that the attitude toward the system positively influences both continued use and the intentions to recommend the service to other people. It is clear that social factors are strong predictors for how gamification is perceived and whether the user will continue to use the service and recommend it to others. We can also see from the results that obviously the larger network you have, the more it's possible to receive recognition from them, and it's also obviously easier to be influenced by their meanings and attitude towards the service. Based on what was found in the study, we can also see the importance of a community having the same goals as you. Social interactions via sharing and being exposed to activities of other users is likely to promote goal commitment towards challenges in the service. The results also strongly indicate that gamification should use mechanisms that afford social interaction. Social elements are essential to create engaging gamification services. That was it. Thank you for listening.
Okay. So, thank you, Thomas. Will either be watching there or will be somewhere later. And if we want to record it up to there, I have to hold this up here so that I don't touch it with my beard. Okay, so in terms of opponent, Pierre, I will try and be the pro while you are the con. So, what questions do you have?
Yeah,
Okay, so in the photography system, your what gets posted are your achievements, and so when people like those posts, they are liking the achievement, right? So it's not necessarily just a measure of aren't you a wonderful person? It's a great achievement, right? So it's a so. So yes, your number of likes will depend on the how large your network is. Yep. So likes are also a measure of popularity rather than independent of popularity, right? Because yes, you're right. If you're a very popular person, you will have more potential likes. Now, you could normalize this by saying, you know, of the people who are following you, what percentage of them liked this activity? Yeah. Now, one of the interesting things in Facebook is, of course, the way that they've tried to curate the communication around likes and around what you see of your friends' activities. They do a bit of testing where they'll show only a small fraction of your friends a particular post. If a large if a high percentage of those engage, then they'll show it to the rest of your friends, right? So they know that not everything you do is equally interesting, which is why from your distant connections, the ones that you are not constantly connecting to, you tend to only see, you know, wedding photos and, you know, baby photo, a new baby photo, right? Because when it was shown to their, like, when the baby photo was shown to their friends, they interacted with it. And therefore, they showed it to the wider network, and then the wider network. So, they have a model on kind of trying to measure popularity before they share it. Photocracy, if people are following you, they get your achievement. So it's more a flat structure there. So you could look at likes not just as an absolute value, but as a percentage of people who are interested in you, right? Do they? In the research paper. I think they just use absolute number. I don't think they use So they and yes, that would skew the results in the terms of saying that, you know, people who are very social and have a lot of connections will also have more likes just because they have more social connections, and therefore they will be more heavily weighted, right? So this is a challenge around any activity you're doing. You have to work out how to balance different opinions or different measurements or like different significance of those measurements, right? So one of the challenges for news media is if you want to create a balanced debate, one idea of balance is you should give 50% of time to each opinion, right? So you have an issue, you find people with those opinions, you give half the weight to the pro, half the weight to the con, that's balance, right? And then you have climate change, where you have 99% of scientists saying, you know, it exists. So you have to actively go out and find the one or two out of 100 who say, no, it doesn't exist. And then you give them 50% of the time, right? Which isn't representative of the opinions of scientists, because it doesn't query 100 of them and show 99 of them saying, well, of course it exists, and then, you know, over an hour-long show, you get 59 and a half minutes of people telling you it exists, and then 30 seconds of someone saying, no, it doesn't. That would be representative, right? So in here, you could say, well, okay, if there's some one person's dominating all of the likes in the system, and you measure something about likes, you're not evenly measuring everybody in the system. You're measuring
that individual's way of behaving. Because they, as you say, they dominate all the likes rather than the percentage. Rather than measuring individuals, you're measuring a feature which more than an individual might have more of. Yeah. Right? And, you know, there's also the challenge if you were talking about one person, one vote, right? One man, one vote. That's that when they first looked at giving women the vote, one of the arguments against it was that married men would have more influence over the political system if you give women the vote. Because married men would tell their women how to vote, and therefore a married man would get two votes and single men would only get one vote. And that was why you shouldn't give women the vote. Yes, honestly, that was an argument against enfranchising women because they felt that it would give a certain portion. Now, in the American politics, the Citizen United argument was the you should allow people to spend money on politics, right? And so, because there, the argument goes, is it individual humans that are important, or do you weight people's opinions by how much money they have? Right, so if every dollar is considered equal, right, then the dollars get to vote. But then the people with the most dollars get the most influence. Right? Whereas if you consider individuals as being equally important, it shouldn't matter how much money you have. You should be equally. You should have equal value. Right? And again, if you look at any measurement system, finding the details on how that works. Now, in photography, because of the nature of the community, it's not massively skewed, right? Generally, that is relatively, like, the way it works is I don't believe that the likes are that massively skewed. So I don't think you'd have that problem. I think it is reasonably distributed across the population. Yeah. Okay, so next question. yes and no.
So, should doctors be doing this instead? And if they say it's a good thing, then I'll allow them to post it. Because modeling business and similar things that have already had massive problems with mental health, such as anorexia.
Mm-hmm. So the idea of and if we go back to it must have dropped it out. Right, okay, so I'll go back here and I'll go back to the presentation.
How the administrators control the labor that way, so they can prevent mental health.
Hello.
I think the answer is that they tend not to. So one question here, I suppose, is if you are referring in this diagram and you're talking about the issues like network exposure and social influence and recognition and reciprocal benefits and attitude and continued use and recommend, right? So yes, this doesn't say anything about whether or not they're recommending good things. And whether these influences are, you know, objectively a good thing, right? So if we applied this to, you know, the KKK, right? A racist community, right? So you have network exposure to a bunch of other racists and who have social influence. So you want the racist to like you. Oh, I didn't actually mean to go forward. So you want the racist to like you. I'll pause it. So you want those racists to like you. You get recognized for how racist you are, and you find some reciprocal benefit of you being racist means they give you jobs and you give them jobs and we get the black people out of the population. And does that influence your attitude towards racism, your intention to remain racist, and your intention to recommend racism to other people. Right? So yes, you could apply this whole network structure to something that was potentially objectively evil. Right? And then you could measure the same things and say, well, do these same factors have the same effect on people in a negative way? Right? So, within the fitocracy, one of the things is that fitness, right, achieving physical activity events are the key, rather than just weight loss, right? So, weight is one of the measures, but it's not the only one. It's certainly not the really the primary one for fitocracy. But the dangers of overdoing fitness, right? So overdoing weight loss, anorexia, definitely a problem, right? Overdoing fitness, yes, you can damage yourself by doing too much of a particular activity to try and achieve something, even when it damages you, right? So and you do see this with some rehabilitation things, and when people are trying to do particular fitness activities. There are occasionally people saying, well, you know, check with your doctor. If you've got a heart condition, you shouldn't try and do this, right? Because it'll stress you and could do more damage than good, right? No, there is not kind of built into the fitocracy community a damping factor to say, don't go crazy, like, don't be stupid, and don't run when you've got a broken leg and screw yourself up for the rest of your life, right? It doesn't natively have that. It kind of relies on people to try and, you know, manage that themselves. You hope that lay people are good enough that a general message on being fit is good for you is okay, right? I think you're right. There are challenges around the being thin is good for you argument, which people can take to extremes. And then damage themselves. But you also get the problem of then if you say, well, you know, it doesn't matter how fat you are, then there are a bunch of people who are larger than they should be, and that is unhealthy for them.
Yeah,
and so,
get the same problem there.
So yeah, so personalizing messages becomes quite important.
Yeah, and that's also the problem that if you do get perfectly fit, according to what a human being should be, and according to doctors and so on, what do you do then?
Okay, so for me, photography generally doesn't have that issue. It has the issue of long-term motivation, right? So any time you gamify something, you've got to worry about what you are doing extrinsically to intrinsic motivation. Games which I think are more obvious are Diet Bet. I showed you guys Diet Bet. I explained it to you guys. I don't know if you guys were here when I explained Diet Bet. Diet Bet is a horrendous, horrendous website. I will put it up again. Where am I? Okay. Diet Bet. In the weight loss community, this is yeah. So. That idea of losing weight, gaining weight back so that you can lose weight again, so you make money by yo-yo dieting because you win the bet by losing weight, then you spend 3 months gaining the weight back again, and then you win money again by losing that weight that you just gained again. Right? Because there's no reward for long-term weight loss. It's just reward for the period in which you're being measured. So, yeah. So, no, that Diet Bet has a far greater chance of you doing those crazy things. And, you know, 400,000 people are playing this screwed up game. Okay, so just for the, if you weren't here, DietBet is a very simple prospect. What you do is you join a group, right? So they put up a particular challenge of losing 4%, like lose 4% of your body weight. And so there is a community of people. So a bet of $35, you put $35 up. There are currently 16 players, which means there's 560 in the pot. They start on the 27th of March. And this is 4% for last day to join, final weigh-in, April. And if you lose the 4% in 4 weeks, you split the pot minus the percentage that DietBet take out of the pot. Right? So the pot is 560. So if you take 16 players and you made it by 35, so that's 350 and... 180, 210, so 300, 200, so it is 560, but there'll be an amount that they take out. I'll just have to work out, they do say in the terms and conditions what percentage they take out of the pot for themselves, for DietBet. But, yes, so, and, you know, if you cheat, if you say you've lost weight without losing weight, you don't take the money away from the site because it's always taking its split of the pot. So the only people you cheat are the other people competing. Right? And so the site doesn't really care if you cheat or not because they always make money. Right? It's only other people who care if you cheat. But, so... Yes. If 100% of people cheat, they'll all lose money, right? But if it, so honest people lose money here for honestly not losing weight, right? But the argument against this is it's motivating by you having put in $35, you're then committing something to losing weight. So the idea is that having committed $35, you're more likely to follow through in your engagement because you have a financial investment in it that you're trying to get that money back, at least, right? And maybe a few extra dollars from those suckers who didn't lie. but DietBet, I think, has much more chance of doing objectively bad things to people by being good at the game and scoring the maximum points, more so than Fitocracy, where I don't think it says as much. Okay, so next question. So, does giving a financial incentive to people alter the results? So, this is...
giving more positive feedback, just to them extra attempt to
given that it's usually pretty easy to work out what a person is trying to measure, right, by the kinds of questions they ask you, depending on when you give people this card, the gift card, and I can't remember, I'd have to look back in the paper and find whether they gave the gift card before you answer the questions or after you answer the questions, right? Because they've so various research has done that into that kind of thing, and yes, you can generate different responses if you give people the gift card first and make sure they know they get to keep it regardless of whether they complete the survey or what they answer to the survey. You can get different results to the, say, do the survey, if you complete it, then we'll give you a gift card. Right? Because...
And because I think it was that a set number of people would randomly give gift cards after the survey was closed.
So almost certainly skews it, right? Because, yeah, at that point, when you have that random number who receive it afterwards, yes, because you go into the draw, that's what it says, you went into a draw for a gift card. Yeah, there'll be a bunch of people who will be influenced just by the, even if they don't think they're being influenced, they don't necessarily think, oh, I'm going to answer good, so I increase my chances of getting it. It's the, oh, I hope they give me the gift card. So you're you are kind of skewed bias towards giving positive results. Also, no, you're not necessarily going to cheat, but you might be nicer to them than you would, because hoping that you'll be selected, because you don't necessarily know that it's random. And even then, there is a chance that they're altered. And this is a challenge when you do like Mechanical Turk. If you use the Amazon's Mechanical Turk as your user base, they are doing the exercise for money, so their motivation is probably skewed by the fact you're paying them. It is something that you are supposed to report in any research you do. And so for all of you doing masters next year, you all, if you provide any kind of incentive to participate, you have to list that, right? You can't just sort of offer people 100 krona to participate and then not tell us that you offered the participants money, right? Because we are then, as researchers, supposed to take into consideration, has that altered the behavior, right? And without knowing it, we wouldn't be able to take that into consideration. So yes, it probably does. Yes, it means that you also, as with the previous example with your paper, and this is why these two kind of line up reasonably nicely, there is that sampling bias issue. Are the kind of people who would engage in this sort of survey and who engage in photocracy kind of socializing of your fitness? Are you just measuring something that would probably be true, that people who engage socially and turn a what many people consider a personal situation of your current fitness into a public thing which you share, because that's what you're doing in photocracy, right? So the kind of people who use photocracy are the kinds of people who are willing to turn a private issue into a public issue and show it to other people. If you're the kind of person who publicizes private issues, does that social influence and reciprocal benefit and network exposure affect your attitude? And does, of that group, does your attitude mean you are likely to recommend something to that network and can keep using it? The answer is, well, probably yes. I would think that would be perfectly reasonable to say. Does it say that, like, does that mean to get more people into the service, you should emphasize these activities? Or are you already saturated on these activities, and to actually get more people into a service, you should be doing all the other things that aren't in here, right? You should be making it less social. You should make it less focused on sharing. You should make it more focused on the individual, because you're already got all the people who are social, right? So the recommendations of what this means for services has to be saying, well, for this kind of person with this kind of motivation, then yes, this seems to work. Okay. Also, I wanted to ask you guys, in general, theory of planned behavior versus self-determination theory. These are different theories around motivations and behaviors. Can you see alignment? Do you think they're, like, which one? Do you think they explain different things? Do they explain the same thing? Are they compatible? Right, because if we look up theory of planned behavior, right? So don't miss out. I'm losing weight. Theory of planned behavior. So you do a Google search for it, you'll find it. Very clearly, Scholar will start saying, hey, there's whole papers and cited many, cited 18,000 times, right? Cited the theory of planned behavior at 46,000 citations. That is a lot, right? In terms of the number of people who cite that particular paper. That's got to be up there in in that group of most cited papers in the world, right? Because that is 40,000 is a lot of citations for a single paper. But if we go back to, rather than go to the PDF, so if we go to the Wikipedia page, I'll bring up this particular diagram, which is the theory of planned behavior initial diagram. Okay, so theory of planned behavior says basically you have an attitude, you have the subjective norm and perceived behavioral controls. The idea is that attitude, what's considered normal in your community, subjective norm, and any perceived behavioral control, so that you're being told to do things, influence your intention, and it's your intention that influences your behavior. Right? So the idea of the theory of planned behavior is that we use our attitude and our subjective and our perceived controls to go directly into our intention to do something, and it's our intention, our planning, to do something that affects the actual behavior. Which means, and basically this is backing up the idea that if you can affect people's intention to do a behavior, you will then affect their behavior. What's the biggest criticism of this? Well, you know, on Wikipedia they do actually you'll find that they have the key concepts, model, formula, evaluation, strength and limitations. So you'll find a limitation section. So some scholars claim that theory of planned behavior is based on cognitive processing and criticize theory on these grounds. So so there are criticisms. One of the challenges is things like quitting smoking. There are a lot of people who intend to quit smoking, but the intention doesn't seem to change the behavior. So in that sense, that strong link between intention and behavior is broken, right? This link for smoking is broken, right? So it doesn't strongly influence. So perceived behavioral control leading to behavior. There's also the dotted line here is around that, you know, if I create laws, sometimes it doesn't matter whether you intend to perform a behavior, you're going to do it because it's the rule, right? It says, so there's the perception, I'm being forced to do this, I wouldn't do it, I had no intention of doing it, it's just I've been told I have to, so I do it, right? So there's you don't have some of those links there. And what he was saying in this paper is that you take this theory of planned behavior and you extend the social, because you saw that they were talking about attitude, right? So it's extending those social network influences, right? So they're saying, like, what affects your attitude and what affects your understanding of what is the subjective norm, right? So the normalizing factors. And the perceived behavioral controls, again, what are there things that influence those? So that's why it's extended in the paper that we've got here. So for self-determination theory, we're talking about agency, competence, and relatedness as being motivators, that you're seeking out those things, which you could say, you know, would be something to do with intention, potentially, but these are subjective norms and attitudes are very different to agency, competence, relatedness, right? So this is not saying what motivates you. This is saying, well, okay, you have an attitude towards something. Why do you have that attitude? You could say, well, that's your motivation, right? So you could try and marry the two together by talking about self-determination theory affecting your attitude, right? So I'm motivated to do this. It could be considered an attitude, right? So... yes, that's my computer. So, in terms of the lights, I go. All right, or it's telling us to leave. we're not moving enough, so it's telling us to leave the room. So in terms of looking at theories, you can see that in this paper, there's a lot of background and builds up a lot of theory. Spends a lot of time in the analysis section as well, right? Talking about how to do all of this measuring of these influences, right? And showing that you guys understood what they meant by like accounting for the percentage of behavior. You understood kind of. There's a lot of technical language that he puts into this, right? And a lot of kind of analysis. It's relatively structured. If you're having problems with it, you can look up those kind of things, right? And the, so it is useful to also see lots and lots of hypotheses all being tested, right? So you can see this is a kind of a hypothesis-heavy paper, whereas the other one didn't really take the same approach. It didn't come up with lots of hypotheses and try and test them. It kind of just did some analysis and and try to talk about and think about what was best. This tries to measure the influences between things. I always worry with fitness, exo gaming kind of things that these two, intention to continue to use and intention to recommend to others, that this is influencing attitude. Attitude leads to intention, right? So this is these they've separated the two types of intention, and then those leading to behavior. With things like fitness and weight loss, right? I know a lot of women, mainly, who intend to lose weight. And a lot of those women don't. So, and creating a system which increases their intention to lose weight, but without helping them turn their intention into a behavior, may not be good, right? So for example, my wife using the Fitbit, right? She wanted to get fitter, right? But its point systems made her feel bad when she didn't achieve, right? Which leads to depression because it sets a whole bunch of objectives and she just didn't want it anymore because it made her feel bad more often than it made her feel good, right? Because she already has a strong intention to lose weight or to get fit in this case, right? So it's not about making the intention stronger. It's about finding ways to make the behavior easier to achieve, right? And so this gamification and these social network influences and all of this, if this is all positively affecting attitude and intention, and raising the attitude and intention up without balancing that off with the actual making the behavior more common, it may actually have the negative effect of making it worse because you are putting more expectations, you're putting higher expectations, you're trying to get, you're driving the person's attitudes and intentions without making it easier for them to achieve. Right? So this kind of study which shows, yes, this is great for increasing the attitude and the intention to use and that, without the what does this do to actual people's weight loss, right? And what happens to all the people who drop off Fitocracy? Do they end up actually worse off because you set up all these expectations and made their intentions and attitudes stronger, which means they feel like failures more when they lose, right? So it is knowing whether this is a benefit is more complex than just knowing does it increase intention to use or intention to recommend. Okay, so next week, Krista, you haven't presented. No. So can we get you to present next week on your topic, which you put down your topic area, which is outside. So I'll give you a topic. I'll look at it this afternoon. I'll try and get it out earlier so that you, because then you got a bit longer. Now, I think it's only you. Everyone else now has presented, right? Because all of you guys have. Yeah, there's an odd number of people left. So I think everyone has presented. So next week, Krista, you'll present because even Thomas, who's remote, had to present, and as did Alex. So we're going to have, you know, all of you present. Now we move into a, because we've got the time to the end of semester to work on the projects, I thought we could move into on these weekly sessions, rather than necessarily you guys, me giving you more papers and you presenting those, is we could go into discussions around the topic areas you're working on, right? So you're going to present next week, and then I'm away the week after, so that which is the week before Christmas, which is the 6th,
I'm away. Yeah, so... Yeah, yeah, so I'm not here that day, so we won't have a class, and you have an oral exam that day, so that would be a silly thing to use up time for anyway. I do want a kind of the beginning of that week, it would be nice to have that, the two or three pager overview of what you're going to write about, right? So in kind of 10 days time, have that overview. Then so you have that exam, then we have Easter, and then so immediately after Easter, we'll come. We'll be having sessions where we discuss the topics, right? So we'll have your write-up, we'll come in, we'll discuss around how you're forming your questions, how you're writing about them, how you're thinking about them, and we'll kind of do how to write research papers in this way, and we'll try and build those up together as a group and giving each other feedback on progress, right? So we'll kind of, and I'll turn it into kind of a how to write about serious games and how to write about research and how to do that kind of research, right? And so that's what we'll do in these sessions. From after Easter, but yeah. So next week it's you, right? And we'll have some discussion around the Alzheimer's stuff, and then exam, then Easter, and then into writing classes around writing around serious games. Yep, makes sense. Okay, great. Well, we'll see you next week.